Good morning to each one. Greet you in Jesus' name, and it is a privilege to be here with you. Good to have visitors, and especially the Clugstons, Dolores. So my thoughts for this morning kind of start out with along the line of how Linwood opened his devotional, obviously with a new year, old year passed, new year coming. How do we feel about that? How do I feel about that? And some of the thoughts that he shared were very real to me. Like, how excited am I about facing a new year? It's a physical reset of the calendar, and it, I think for most of us, we probably do spend a little extra time thinking about back what took place in our past and thinking about the future, and it can be kind of unsettling to us as humans. At least I find it that way, and especially probably what makes it maybe more real to me over this time of the year is 5 years ago, I lost a nephew in an accident on New Year's Eve. So it was right at the end of a year, the beginning of a new year. And now, as we have family gatherings at Christmas and over that time, it's always that incident is fresh on our minds as extended family. And so you're together to celebrate being together as family. You're together celebrating Christmas or New Year's or whatever it is. And so it's supposed to be a time of rejoicing, of being happy. And yet we have to hold, in the other hand, the sorrow of the loss. And especially for his parents, the reality of, you know, they say that time heals pain, and there's an element of truth to that, but the thing about a loss like that is it doesn't erase the reality of the loss or the consequences of that loss. Especially, to put it plainly, for Keith and Kathy, he was more involved with Keith's occupation, and it felt like that Alex would have been the one that would have been able to step in as they phase out and in the business. And so that changed all that, the dynamics of what Keith had to look forward to from an occupational standpoint. So it was a loss of a child, a loss of dreams, a loss of a lot of different things. And so I my heart hurts for them each anniversary of that loss. And so what am I saying? I've said this different times, but to us as humans, God asks us to be able to hold two different elements at the same time, and we struggle to do that. As humans, we easily are deterred off to the negative side of life, where life is terrible and everything is bad and it's never going to be good. Or sometimes we have, as men especially, may have the ability to just block the bad stuff out, and we're just going to be happy. Life is good, and it's all roses, straight up. Neither one of them is healthy. But to hold the combination, I believe, is where reality is and what God desires of his children. We have different Bible verses bringing out that thought. And so as we look to a new year, are we afraid of what might happen? At our Christmas gathering, my dad is 86 and battling cancer, and so that's a real emotional, physical battle he's facing, and we as a family along with him. And he came up to me and said, I don't know that I'll be here next Christmas. I have a feeling that I won't be. And so we're celebrating Christmas, we're celebrating family, and yet we realize change is inevitable, and when will it be? The unknowns tend to unsettle us. And so I'm sure you get that. But the song we sang there, the Whispering Hope, the chorus said, making my heart in its sorrow rejoice. So there you have it. Your heart, we need to go to God, that the sorrows we have, can we take them to him, that our heart can still have rejoicing within it. So my message title of the morning, sort of, yeah, the verse I picked out, it comes from the phrase of a verse, Jesus, a very present help in trouble. That's out of Psalms. I like the wording that David used, a very present help. Very close, and he's very present in time of trouble. As Paul was given kind of his state in life, he made the comment in 2 Corinthians, Paul said, as in sorrow, yet always rejoicing. And you could see the battles and the struggles that Paul himself went through, and yet he maintained a positive attitude through those struggles. It says, in sorrow, yet always rejoicing. And John 16:33, a very familiar verse, in this world ye shall have trouble. These are Jesus' very words. In this world ye shall have trouble. It's not if or maybe, but it's, Jesus said, it is a reality that there's going to be trouble in this world. But he, the second part of that verse, be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. Like, Jesus, what do you mean? You tell us trouble, but be of good cheer. How do you put them together? But he put them together right there in the same verse. He said, be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. I have went through it. You can also, and I'm here, a very present help in time of trouble. So I like that verse of how Jesus was holding the two concepts right there for us to somehow try to grasp them. He was calling us to grasp the thought of trouble and cheerfulness, because the only way that is possible is because he has overcame the world already. He is the victor. And with him on our side, we have the assurance of victory also. So that leads me into the thought of another verse in Proverbs 23. Yea, though, this was a very familiar verse also. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. The concept I want to leave with you part of today is the thought of, as we look at tests and trouble and trials, we need to develop the ability to see past them or beyond them. And as that verse used the word through the valley of the shadow of death, through troubles, through trials. That's what Jesus was about, was getting us through. We tend to think we're getting led into this trap of trouble in the year, possibly in the year of 2026. What for snares or what for traps are out there that we're going to walk into, and we don't know if we're going to be able to make it through? Like, that's just could be the end. Because we could get ensnared, or something could come upon us that we can't take, and fear overwhelms us, or can overwhelm us, and we can become very unsettled. But the thought of being able to walk through the valley of the shadow of death with Jesus by our side is helpful, to be able to grasp that it's a process we're asked to walk. It's not an end in itself, the trouble that we hit, although it often feels that way. So I'm going to spend just a little bit of time here on where do these troubles come from? Now, this is probably not a real safe discussion maybe to open up, because it can get really, really, back and forth. But what is the source of the troubles that come upon us? Like, and you may ask, well, if it's pretty hard to nail it all down, why do you even bring it up? Well, I think it can be helpful in our processing as we find ourselves in the trials and tests of life, to be able to grasp some elements of where it could be coming from. And obviously, there's different sources that our troubles can come from. And I'll just say right up front, I don't know that it's always the most important part is to figure out where they're coming from is maybe not as important as how we deal with them, although knowing where they come from at times can be helpful. So for me, like, number one, some of our troubles and tests, trials, whatever, I'm lumping a lot of things all together when under the word trouble. It can be temptations, all that falls under that category in my mind and what I'm talking about today. But some of our tests and trials and troubles are self-inflicted. Let's be honest. We as humans make decisions, and sometimes we make wrong decisions, and it gets us in a mess. And so they're self-inflicted. I think we would all probably agree with that, that in humanity, we make a mistake or we go against better knowledge, we sometimes say. So the combination of different elements of walking through life, some of our troubles are we bring upon ourselves. The second one that we often talk about is, well, the devil. The devil's behind all bad things. Like if there's some test or trial or temptation you're going through, it was the devil trying to defeat you. He's just trying to destroy you. And that is true. He is trying to destroy us. And I'm not minimizing that. But I don't think it's quite fair to give him that credit that he's that powerful, that he's simply like a flood upon us of all this negativity and the hard times that come on us don't all directly, we don't credit him with every incident that comes upon us. Now, he is evil. He is the source of evil. And so if you take it back far enough, maybe you could make the case that all bad does come from the devil. But in reality, let's be careful. That's sort of a little bit of an easy way out sometimes, just to say, well, the devil made me do it. It was the devil. And so that. And in the case of Job, you could make that conclusion that because of the discussion God had with Satan, that God gave Satan the permission to afflict Job. And so there is that element of truth in that. But through it all the different ways that trouble come upon us, we must come to grasp that God ultimately allowed it. So does that mean we blame God? Like everything that comes our way, every bad thing is because of God, because he could have stopped it. He allowed it. So then he's responsible for all the bad things that we have to go through. Well, I'm pretty sure we don't want to really go that direction either, because God does care for us. He wants good for us, and yet he allows these for our good, and even though they're not enjoyable to us. So the case can be made that, yes, he's involved, and he is involved with everything in our life too. What about Murphy's Law? Now, I'm a big believer in Murphy's Law, and I'm not sure why, but it just seems like in my life as a farmer with animals, anything that can happen will happen. It's like, so where does that fall in? Is God behind Murphy's Law? Is the devil behind it? Are we behind it? Whatever. So this past week, I was in my hog barn, and I have what I call a dead sled that that I use to get the deceased pigs out of the pen to where they need to go. And it has this cable with a loop on the end as a snare, basically, that's how I hook them up with a winch. And this one pig liked to jump out of its pen and run the alleys, and it irritates me. And so what happened really wasn't that sad, I should admit. But don't you know that pig somehow, in the process of nuzzling around or messing around in the alleyway, got his nose in that snare on that dead sled, and I guess backed up, and it had him by the nose. Like, what's the chances of, if you tried to go in a pen with a snare to catch a pig, how easy would it be? Would they just walk up and open their mouth and say, here, snare me? Not really, but this pig, on its own free will, somehow got caught by the snare. I call that Murphy's Law. That's what I mean by Murphy's Law. What can happen will happen, and it did happen. And the pig, yeah, you can imagine how that all was. I wasn't there at the beginning, so I don't know how much wailing and screaming there was, but I do know how it all ended, and he's in sausage in a cooler. So Murphy's Law, where does that come in? And maybe that's... But as you think of where I'm going to go, keep going, is we're going to look a little bit about nature. And so God created nature, created the weather and all that. And so how much of it did God, like, he filled the gas tank, he got the world spinning, he got everything going around in space. Like, does he get up in the morning every day and you got to refuel it and tell the earth to spin at a certain speed and tell the sun to come up and all? No, he created it, he put it in order, and it works on its own, is the way I see it. And so there are elements that happen in our life that they're not coincidental. I don't like the word coincidental, because every experience we have, there's something we can learn from it. But some things, like the law of sowing and reaping, and like gravity, the laws that God has put in place, if we go against them, there's consequences, and it's not necessarily a fault of anyone necessarily, but just how things came together. So there is that element also. But we, as I had said, God allows the hardships. Why? Is I think the ultimate goal is to draw us closer to him and for us to understand him better, and so that we realize we have a need for him. If we don't need God, if we don't have any needs, we don't really need God, is how our minds often work. So when we find ourselves in need, it's a reality that we are needful creatures. So he is a very present help in time of trouble. And the prayer that we were taught to pray says, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And I just, as I thought of that phrase again, I was blessed to think that God is here to deliver us, to get us through, not to lead us into. And can we get that straight in our mind? God is not a God of leading us into temptation, leading us into the trouble that we face, but he's a God of deliverance. We pray that lead us not into temptation, but deliver us. God wants to get us through it and deliver us in it. And so that is God's heartbeat, that we don't look at it that the trouble is the end in itself, but lean on him, because he is the deliverer through these times and tests of life. Turn with me to Mark 4. Mark 4, 35 to 41. I'm going to read these verses. Mark 4, 35. And the same day, when the even was come, he saith unto them, let us pass over unto the other side. And when they had sent away the multitude, they took him, even as he was, in the ship. And there were also with him other little ships. And there arose a great storm of wind, and the waves beat into the ship, so that it was now full. And he was in the hinder part of the ship, asleep on a pillow. And they awake him, and say unto him, Master, carest thou not that we perish? And he arose, and rebuked the wind, and said unto the sea, peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said unto them, why are ye so fearful? How is it that ye have no faith? And they feared exceedingly, and said one to another, what manner of man is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him? So this is the passage that I look to for some of the thoughts of the morning, the thought of trials that come upon us, the tests that come upon us. Can we grasp some of the truth through this recorded trial that these disciples went through? So the Sea of Galilee, never been there. It'd be nice to be there and see it. It would probably add a total different dimension. But it's believed that this was the Sea of Galilee that this storm came up on. The Sea of Galilee, they say, is 8 miles wide, 13 miles long, roughly. So it's not a real big sea, but it is the lowest body of water on earth that is fresh water. There are lower, like the Dead Sea is lower, but it's a salt kind of ugly, ucky, mucky, I guess. But this is a freshwater sea with, they say, fish galore, and it is actually very, very, like, Israel still relies on it for maybe like 50% of its water or something. I was reading some different things. But so at a beautiful place because there's mountain ranges all around it. It's kind of like a bowl down low, obviously, 700 feet below sea level, roughly, with mountain ranges kind of all around it and enclosing it. And so it lends itself to bad storms. It's like you have wind currents or the different degrees of temperatures, what creates disturbance of wind. And some of you know much more about that than I do. But as the cool air comes down off the mountain range in the evening and you have warm, moist air from the water on the bottoms colliding, it creates turbulence and it creates wind and it creates storms. And so this is not was not a miracle in itself that there was a storm. And so I don't know why I'm bringing this point out other than it wasn't a miracle that there was a storm on the Sea of Galilee. It was kind of a common occurrence. And so I guess what I'm here to say is, did God create this trouble and tragedy, or it didn't end up being a tragedy. He thought it was going to be. This storm, did God create that he could teach these disciples a lesson of who Jesus was? Well, not necessarily. You call it coincidental. You call it being out at sea enough in your life that you're going to come up on storms. And so, for whatever that's worth, it wasn't an unusual thing to have a storm come up. And it says it was Eve, so that was a likely time for this. If you look at the context, it's a little hard to get a full handle on the time frame or the context of this passage here, but it's pretty clear as you spend a little time reading that Jesus was in the very height of his ministry as far as the multitudes were pressing in on him, and he was overworked in his human ability. And he was very, very busy at this time in his life. So up until this time, you had him performing many miracles. He was performing miracles of physical healing upon people. The lame were walking. The blind were given their sight. So he was given obvious demonstrations of his power over the physical element of the body. And he also was casting out demons to those that were demon-possessed. And so he showed his power and superiority in the spiritual world. But this here miracle that happened of him calming the sea was actually a total different element of a miracle than any other miracles that he had performed, and that he revealed through this miracle that he had power over nature itself, which shouldn't be that surprising because he created nature. So isn't the creator more powerful than the created? We get that concept, but Jesus had never really dealt with the nature weather element in his ministry up until this time. Unless Peter may have walked on the water, or God came walking on the water, might have been before this, I'm not sure. So that was sort of a power over nature thing when Jesus walked on the water also. But those two miracles were showing his power over nature. So basically there was no other miracles that he could do to give them confidence or to reveal his power in any other realm. So this brings me to a question, like, this came up in Sunday school a couple weeks ago in our Sunday school class, of the humanity of Jesus. Like, how human was Jesus? Like, it says he was tempted in all points like we are, and yet we have a hard time grasping that concept because we know he was God's son and he was God. So was he God or was he human? So was he 50%? Like, his body was human. He was born and he was in a human body the same as you and I. So was he 50% in that he was a body, but inside in his spirit he was God. So he was God walking around in a human body. Was he 50-50? And I think it was Jaron that made the comment that he feels like Jesus was 100% human and 100% God. And I would agree with that analysis. And so it's still hard for us to get a handle or a grip on that, because what does that mean? 100%, 200%, how? But the closest thing that I can bring it to reality to us is the idea of what we talk about in marriage. We say a husband and a wife, or a man and a woman in the marriage union, are bringing 100%. You don't just bring 50%, but you give of yourself, each of you giving 100%. The Bible says you become one flesh. So there's two of you, but the Bible said you become one flesh, so you're 100% one. And yet, you're still man, you're still woman. So how can you be 100% in a marriage? And so I think it's the same concept, though, that even though you're still 100% man, you're still 100% woman. If you made the very marriage vows, you promise that from that day forward, there's going to be a different element of decision-making of life's... It's 100% different. Like, every decision that gets made should, in a healthy marriage, get made taking in consideration the natural elements of a woman versus man, and everything that gets done is supposed to be a union of 100%. So that's as close as I can get to describing how Jesus could be 100% human and 100% God at the same time. So I guess my desire this morning, I didn't start out this way, I wanted, but is to lift Jesus high. And maybe in my analysis of this passage that you might think I'm lowering him, but that is not my desire at all. I want to bring reality to us in a way that we can pull Jesus closer and we can understand him as a fellow human that is relatable. He's relatable. And to get that concept, I think it's good to understand whether he was human or whether he was God. And we talked about that. So to paint the picture of the context just a little bit more around this passage is, this was talked about in Matthew and Luke also, and so they all give a little bit of the verses leading up to it a little bit different, but and it says in this passage that there was multitudes. They had to send the multitudes away before they went over to the other side. So we know he was surrounded with huge groups of people, and we know he was preaching from a human body, even though God was dwelling within him. And so leading up to this passage in Luke, I think it is where he says, the foxes have holes, the birds have nests, but the Son of Man don't even have a place to lay his head. And that was just previous to this him saying, we need to go to the other side of the water. Can you get that picture? Somebody came up, and I feel like in his humanity, he was spent. He was wore out, and he was tired. And he said, the animals have a better resting place, or able to rest better than I am. I'm the Son of God, but I don't even have a place to lay my head. Is the picture I get of the context of this passage that we're looking at of him calming the storm, that he was at the end, he was exhausted, and it was preceding this in the Luke account is where some people come running up. There's a multitude around him again, and people come running up to him and said, Jesus, your mom and your brothers are in the crowd. They desire to come see you. Jesus said, those that are in this crowd that hear my word and do it, they are my mother, they are my brethren. And we just kind of, I've always just like, what did that all mean? Like, stop there. What did it mean? I don't know. But could have Jesus been saying, my mother, and my blood brothers desire to see me, I would love to spend some time with them. But I have this whole multitude, and I'm called to be responsible for them. I have so many people that I want to have the same relationship with as I do my mom and my brothers. And it's like, I just see him being overwhelmed as a human. Like, I can't reach around. I don't even have time to let my mother come sit with me and visit me, because I'm busy taking care of multitudes of people and their needs. And so we see in this passage in Mark, it was getting towards evening, and the multitudes were still pressing him on the hillside. And he told his disciples that were close to him, he said, we need to go to the other side. And it says, the disciples, or whoever you want to call them, they sent the multitudes away. Jesus didn't have a parting word. He didn't say, goodbye, I'll see you tomorrow. He didn't say, please give me some space. He turned to his disciples and said, I'm done. I got to go. And so they sent the multitudes away, and it said in verse 36, they took him even as he was in the ship. They took him even as he was. What does that mean? Why is that worded that way? Or why is that they took him even as he was? I think there's significance to that, but I'm not sure what it is. Like, they didn't spend any extra time. They didn't say, we're hungry, let's catch some fish, let's eat a snack, let's eat supper, and then we'll go over. But I think they saw in Jesus, here, I'm adding probably more than I should to the story, but I want to make it real. And if it's not fact, just get your let your minds go with it for the sake of the point, that they saw on his face that he needed a rest, or that his desire, they were going to complete and fulfill it. And so no extra whatever, they took him as he was. I don't know what that means, but there was something about that situation that they made it happen instantly. In Luke's account, it used the word, they sailed. So it was extremely peaceful. They didn't need to row this boat, but they had their sails up, and there was a gentle breeze going across the Sea of Galilee, that when they turned the sails, their boat just glided, or started gliding across this peaceful, calm sea. And what did Jesus do? He fell asleep. He fell asleep at the back of the boat. Rest for his humanity. If he was all God, he wouldn't have needed to sleep. He would have continued to preach. But he had humanity, that his humanity was real to him, that he could relate to every incident we go through. Every incident we go through, he can grasp it 100% because he lived it. See, he's sleeping and he's tired and he's in a deep sleep. And this storm came upon them like a hurricane, literally. The waves were encompassing the ship. The boat was full, it said, or was getting full in the one. And here the disciples, or whoever with them, were obviously bailing water in desperation, and they thought it was the end. And they were in fear, and someone happened to think, you know, the master is here. They said, Master, carest not that we perish. In another account, it said, they said, Lord, save us. Either way, they came to the point of surrender, I'll call it, or the end of their self. And they surrendered the ability to save the ship on their own. And they knew they had to turn to, their only hope was to turn to the higher power. And the highest power they knew or had was right with them. But he was sleeping. They had to get him awake. and say, Master, don't you care about us perishing? What do you feel like when you're woke out of a deep sleep? How did Jesus feel? He said he rebuked the winds. The same as he would have talked to casting out a demon, he talked to the wind. Now, he could have said it gently. Peace, be still. Like, wind, calm down. But he said he rebuked it. Was he angry? Was he frustrated? I don't know. But he rebuked it the same as he was dealing with an evil power. I think he was like, I was sleeping and I got disturbed. All because you guys think that we're going to perish. I created the nature. You think I'm going to let nature kill me? Like, I got this, but you don't realize it. He rebuked it and he said, peace be still. And the amazing part is, like when, and it said it instantly, peace came. So you can stop the wind, but what do you think the waves were doing? If you have 5-foot waves crashing out to the edge of the coast, what are they going to do when you hit the edge? They're going to come back in. So you could say this, that all of a sudden the storm quit. What's the big deal about that? Well, it's the water also. He rebuked the winds and the waves. The waves all just died down instantly. It was calm and peaceful immediately when he spoke the word. That's amazing. That is a true miracle. So you see Jesus, and his comment was, after the winds and the waves were taken care of, he turned to his disciples or those that were with him, and he said, why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith? What do you do with that? It seemed like a little bit, I don't know if I want to use the word harsh, but if you're in a boat and you think you're going to sink, there's some panic involved, and you're not too restful and you're fearful. It's a natural instinct of man to stay alive, and that's just a given. And so if you think your boat's going to go down, you're going to be doing all you can just to keep it upright. But Jesus turned and said, where's your faith? Why are you so fearful? Was it like this was his core group of followers, the people that were close to him day in and day out, and his purpose for calling them was that they would get a grip of who he was, the Son of God. Even though he was human in appearance, he was performing God's miracles. Blind were seeing, thousands were being fed out of a small lunchbox. But this storm came up, and this core group of followers, they had forgot about the lunches, they had forgot about the blind seeing, they forgot about all that 100% God stuff that Jesus had just done that very day, basically. Was Jesus frustrated? I don't know. Was he like, how long is this going to take for them to get that I have it? That if they would trust in me, that they would have faith in me, that this is going through. This is not an end. we don't know what I don't know what all that entailed. But is that, I think we touched it in Sunday school. One thing I do see in this passage that I think is pretty important is that we see surrender before supernatural. The disciples had to come to an end of themselves before the miracle took place. We as humans want to reverse that. We go to Jesus and say, do something supernatural, and then I will trust in you. And Jesus don't operate that way. He's like, you trust in me. You have faith in me. If you can have just a little bit of faith, you're going to see supernatural things happen. But if you're just going to sit back and say, I'm not sure about Jesus. I'm not sure about God. I'm not sure that he can take care of me. I'm going to wait and see what he does for me, and then I'll make a decision of how much faith I can have. Jesus is not going to reach too far to help us in that state, I don't think. He has grace and he has love, but he'll probably let us sit there until we start thinking, you know, I need Jesus. I have no abilities of my own. And when we get grasp that we're at the end and we have nothing more to offer or to do to get us out of a situation, surrender, the supernatural, we open up the realm or the possibilities for supernatural to happen at that point. We say, do the supernatural, and then we'll have faith in you. Jesus said, have a little faith, and I'm going to do supernatural. So I was talking about Jesus and giving you a glimpse of maybe how some of that could have worked. But now I just want to spend a little bit of time on the disciples themselves. It was amazing when Jesus said, let's go over to the other side. The disciples took action immediately. They sent them away. They manned the boat across. They were manning the boat across the water. Jesus was allowed to sleep. They were being very obedient. They were doing exactly what they thought their master wanted them to do, and that's what he wanted them to do. They were dealing with issues that he turned over to them to deal with. And so they were in 100% compliance, I see, in everything in this day that led up to this situation. Things were peaceful, and they were doing what their master would desire them to do. They were taking responsibility. They were helping the process. And so I was blessed by that thought, that he said the word, and they stepped right in and started taking action, and he was able to sleep, but in that peace and that inner obedience, and then it wasn't this storm wasn't something to of revenge upon them. They were being good Christians, but it still came. It still came. Let's be careful that when troubles come, especially to other people, it's not really up to us to say, well, I think they're going through that because of such and such. Now, if it's our trouble, you can think about it, but be careful, because it's not always that they did something wrong, or that in this case, I don't think the disciples weren't being taught a lesson because of something that they weren't accomplishing, for whatever that's worth. You know what's interesting is, so the storm came up, they were fearful, and Jesus, can we say he called them out on it a little bit? He said, you know, why don't you have a little more faith? Why are you fearful? The very next verse, as he looked at them and told that to them, what happened? They said, and they feared exceedingly. They were afraid, and now they're very, very fearful. Like, this storm was bad. But now we have a man in our boat that was able to have more power than the storm itself. What about me? Who am I to be in the same boat with a man that can tell the winds and the waves to behave, and they listen immediately? There was power in that boat, unbelievable, and they realized it. And they saw themselves for who they were, and they were almost like as dead men. They thought, get me out of here. I am not close to being worthy of being in this boat with him, I think is what was going on. And that is we can call it a wow factor. We can call it, you can put different terminology onto it, but it's simply awe of God. We can criticize the disciples for their lack of faith, for their here he called, they said they shouldn't be afraid, but here they even got more afraid. And it's like, what's wrong with them? Can't they learn a lesson? I want us to take it a different way, that we're no different than them. They were human. We are human. God is so much above us. He is human. He was human as he walked this earth to the point that he can relate to every incident we go through. And yet he is God so much above us that we cannot relate, and we'll never be able to get a hand or a grip on what God is trying to do totally in our lives. We can't prepare for the trouble and the storms. I mean, we can, but we can't. If we could prepare totally, I'll say we wouldn't need God. But this was a wow experience and an awe and a reverence for God in the boat with them that was able to calm that storm. And I hope and I pray that we maintain that can continually happen in our lives, that we may have hardly any faith. And the one passage said he didn't have any faith, and the other passage said, why did you have so little faith? So they're on a line there. They must almost have faith. And I think that's probably where most of us are, that we don't know if we have even a little faith. But when God works, if we surrender ourselves and the supernatural takes place, can we give him the credit and stand back in awe and say, wow, I don't deserve to be part of this. One other thing I want to leave you with facing 2026. Just look at how this was. Chapter 4 of Mark, verse 35. Jesus said, let us pass over unto the other side. Look on down the passage to the first verse of chapter 5. And they came over unto the other side of the sea. How awesome is that? 2026, we can fear that we're going to hit some things that's going to almost destroy us or take us under, and we can be fearful. But to think that if we have Jesus in our ship, that he said, it's through. Let us go over, and you're going to get to the other side. This storm came up. There was all kinds of disturbance, but they got through to the other side. What more do we want, brothers and sisters, to have the confidence that we have Jesus on our side, and when he starts a mission in our life, that he has more, he's more than capable to get us through to the other side. Yeah, there's storms in the middle, but when he says, we're going, get on board, and you're going to get to the other side. I bless each one of you in this new year of 2026. There will be things happen. We don't know today what they will. Lots of good things we hope and pray for. And some of us will probably face some things that are not enjoyable. And we can fear that. But can we look at this passage and realize that if we're on a mission with the Master, there's a promise of the opposite shore. God bless you.